AveuCentral.com. That's AveuCentral.com.
This is a paid commercial program and may not represent the views of Bonneville International Corporation or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions from this broadcast are solely those of the individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP, the federal leader in retirement planning seminars. Join NITP this morning for an hour of plain talk on planning your future. You've got questions, they've got answers.
Good morning and welcome to For Your Benefit. So, it's never too early to think or worry about taxes. So we're going to worry and talk about taxes this morning. Ed Zerndorfer, certified financial planner, retired federal employee, enrolled IRS agent. That's very important. Chartered life underwriter, chartered financial consultant. I could spend 53 minutes going through all your titles, Ed. Good morning, Ed.
Good morning, Bob. Thanks for having me.
And it's great to see you here. And Ed's also a fellow seminar presenter with NITP. My name is Bob Lines. I'm a CPA, tax, finance type. And so we're going to talk about taxes, what to worry about or what not to worry about. Promise we'll keep you awake. And why don't we take a look at this thing first, because we're headed towards the end of the year, of course, December 31st, and we have some expiring benefits that we don't know that they're going to be extended or not, but we probably can figure that some of them aren't. Not that we know, and not that Congress has given us any peeks, but the first thing, I'll do the easy one, Ed. You do the hard ones. We're thinking about capital gains rates going up next year from 15% to 20%. So, you know, is it time then for people to sell whatever they have just to save the taxes, or say, listen, I'm going to keep it riding, and if I pay a higher tax later, it's better than getting out and maybe not taking the ride? What do you think?
Well, there's a saying, Bob, in the investment world, we should not let the tax tail wag the investment dog. And what I advise people is that if you were thinking about selling something that has gone up in value, and let's face it, the stock market has had a roller coaster over the past couple of years. But if you own something, a capital asset, a stock, a bond, a mutual fund that you hold outside of a retirement account, outside of an IRA, outside of a 401k, outside the TSP, and you're thinking about selling it this year because you have a use for the money in a different way, this would be the year to sell it, because there is a flat 15% capital gain, long-term capital gains tax for people who are in a 25% or higher marginal tax bracket. Interesting, people who are in a 10 or 15% tax bracket would pay 0% tax on that capital gain, if you will, if they sell it. But again, there has to be a reason why you're selling it. You shouldn't sell it just to save, quote-unquote, on taxes. You have to have a good reason. Of course, we're just talking about federal taxes. If you live in a state that has a state income tax, you also have to consider what's going to be the state income tax consequences of your selling your capital asset.
Okay, but Ed, when you mentioned tax brackets, and I mentioned tax brackets in the class, and I'm not so sure people truly understand, but when you mentioned the 15% or the 10, what we're talking about is a single individual would be in a 15% bracket if their taxable income, and taxable income is not their salary, is roughly $34,000 or higher. But on a joint situation, it would be $68,000 or higher. So these folks, roughly speaking, these folks are saying, well, should I sell it now and pay no tax? And I think I'm hearing you say, don't let the tax tail wag the economic dog. Is that what you said?
Yes, that's what I'm saying. There has to be a reason behind this. We shouldn't start selling things for the sake of selling things just to save on taxes.
Right. And I remember in school way back when that my tax instructor, I'll just never forget it. And he said, a deferred tax is the best type of tax.
That's true. Of course, we always like to believe that no tax at all is the best type of tax of all. If we can somehow come up with something that we don't pay any tax on, and we should look into that as well.
All right, and sometimes, I don't know about you, if you ever get accused of this in class, people would say, you know, they have to collect tax revenues to fund government benefits for us all, and I don't argue with that, but the idea is not to pay no tax, it's to take whatever you have, and some things you're just going to pay taxes on, salary, annuity benefits. There's just no way around, no one's suggesting that, but on the investment side of life, for an investment to grow, it's very tax sensitive if taxes are taken from it on an annual basis rather than a deferred basis. So it's really an economic thing rather than dodging taxes.
That's correct. We're really talking about, in some cases, avoiding taxes rather than evading taxes. You know, we have to pay our fair share of taxes, and we all complain about the amount of taxes that we pay. But when you look at other countries, the tax rates in the United States are really not that high. I mean, what's the highest marginal tax bracket? 35% currently. You go to some countries, Europe, Asia, they're talking about tax rates as high as 60, 70, 70%. As you know, 30 years ago, the tax rates in this country were as high as 80%. We've come down a long way.
I remember those. I'm sorry to say that I remember them well. And then they had a lower tax if you worked. You know, your earned income was taxed at a lesser rate. And then it's down to half of what it was.
Really can't complain.
All righty. What other, just looking at this chart that we were both looking at this morning, another thing for individuals, some people claim what's called a standard deduction. They don't itemize, they've paid the house off, or they didn't have a house to pay off. So they don't have interest per se, they don't have real estate taxes per se, but they received a standard deduction of a certain percentage of what a single person would get. But that's going to drop back down.
For married people who file jointly, the so-called marriage penalty for people who were, in the past, people who had filed as single, took a standard deduction, got whatever amount is, for example, they got their standard deduction was let's say, $4,000. This is a single person. And somebody who filed as married filing jointly got a standard deduction, you would think it would be twice as much, of $8,000. But it turned out to be that it was like $7,000. And the question comes up, why? It makes sense. You're talking two people, married filing jointly. They should just double the standard deduction, but it wasn't. So the way the tax brackets were constructed and so on, the standard deduction was roughly 167% for a married couple of the standard deduction for a single person. But there was some provisions back, I think, in 2000 that changed that to double the standard deduction for a married filing jointly of the standard deduction for a single person, but that's due to expire. We're supposed to go back to 167% again unless Congress changes that. Now, Congress is not in session until they'll probably come back after the election in November, and hopefully some of the things we're talking about now will be fixed by Congress, but they're due to expire as of December 31st, 2010.
Okay, so for those of you all listening to that, there was something called a marriage penalty, and I still have clients ask, well, how much is my marriage penalty? Well, there isn't one if you itemize. It's if you claim this, quote, standard deduction where uncle gives you a flat amount, and that's going to become a smaller flat amount. So the marriage penalty is back in, but for those people that don't itemize married filing jointly. This is probably more high-end stuff, but if an individual maybe retires and they have a large amount of accumulated leave, or it's a dual family income, or it's a single person working two jobs, I mean, potentially they could get into this, where they start to lose some of their personal exemptions if their income exceeds a level, and that was thrown out in 2010, but it looks like it might come back in 2011. And also for people, let's say people that live in a state that don't have necessarily state income tax, but they might have high sales taxes. They could deduct state sales taxes for maybe large purchases of automobiles. But it looks like that's gone at the end of the year.
Yes, that for federal employees who live in states with no state income taxes, like Florida, Nevada, Texas, Wyoming, South Dakota, state of Alaska, state of Washington, New Hampshire, I believe Tennessee, Those residents look forward to deducting their sales tax because if they itemize, because they cannot deduct any state income tax because there is no state income tax. So this was a real benefit to residents of those states. So hopefully something will be done to extend that particular tax benefit.
Okay. Educational benefits. They have all these different credits for going to school. American Opportunity Credit. And then American Opportunity Credit at the end of 2010 would expire, but there's still the HOPE credit. And I for the life of me, I have a mental block with these credits. You know, there's the Lifetime Learning, and there's the American Opportunity, there's a HOPE Scholarship Credit. And first of all, what's a credit?
A credit is a deduction dollar for dollar from your tax liability. We always look forward to getting good tax credits because it reduces the bottom line what we're paying in taxes, whereas a tax deduction reduces your income that is subject to taxes. If you have a choice, you should always go for a tax credit, not a tax deduction.
So let me make sure I understand it. So if I have a $100 credit, it reduces my tax $100.
That's correct.
But if I have a $100 tax deduction and I'm in the mythical 25% federal tax bracket, I save $25 in taxes.
That's correct.
Okay,
that's correct.
I just need to understand.
But one of the unfortunate things of most credits, and to some extent deductions, is that they are subject to income. If your income is too high, you do not benefit from the credits because Congress set it up so that people who have high incomes cannot take advantage of the credits or, in many cases, the deductions. And I get a lot of people coming to my office during tax season and look forward to, oh, I can save so much in taxes this year because I have a child in college and so on. I says, wait a minute, we got to look at your income. So we have to bring them down to earth in terms of the reality of the case.
And they're none too happy when you bring them down, right?
No, they're not very happy customers.
And I have to remind them, do not shoot the messenger. Now, for those of y'all listening, you can talk to us till 10:58 and a half Eastern Time. Today is October 4th, 2010. And you can call us directly at 202-465-3080. 202-465-3080. We're going to initially talk about expiring tax benefits at the end of 2010. We're going to talk about Roth conversions. We're going to talk about opportunities to potentially lower your 2010 income tax by doing year-end tax planning. We're going to make an educated guess on what we think tax rates will be in 2011. Remember, it's an educated guess. Recharacterizing a Roth IRA. And if we have time, we'll try to make sense out of this thing called alternative minimum tax. We won't make sense out of it, but we'll try to explain how it works. Energy credit. Energy credit is kind of a hot, I would say, thing the last 2 years. But if I'm not mistaken, Ed, doesn't it go away at the end of this year?
It goes away at the end of December and most likely will not be renewed by Congress. That's my understanding because they have already extended it for 2 years. The good part about the energy tax credit is that there is no income limitations. No matter what your income is, you can get this tax credit as much as up to $1,500. But since it is going to be expiring at the end of December, here's the rule. Not only must you buy this particular and you get some type of energy efficient, something like a furnace or storm doors, air conditioner that meets government standards, but this particular item that you buy must be installed by December 31st. You can't buy it in December and have the repair person come out in January to install your new furnace. It actually has to be installed by December 31st. So if anybody's interested in getting this particular tax credit, make sure you, if we're in October now, start contacting the appropriate repair people to get your particular energy efficient item installed by December 31st.
Yeah, we've come to the end, hopefully, of the hot season, and I noticed the air conditioner at home was doing less than what I thought it should be. So I called up my friend that does the plumbing work, and I said, his name is Bob. Bob, why don't we try to do this before the end of the year? Because then I'll save $1,500. And he looked at me. He says, Bob, you're the accountant here. He said, why would I come in, put a new condenser unit in, if maybe we can just come and see if it needs a tweak here and there? And that was the issue. So I got caught up in the credit, and I hate to tell you how long I've been doing this, but it gets back to, you know, economic reality versus tax benefit. There's a making work pay credit. I think people may have missed this on their tax return. They shouldn't, because it was $400 per person, wasn't it? Or
I believe $400 per person, $800 for a couple.
Yeah.
I believe.
And all you had to do was work. And I don't believe that had an income ceiling, or did it?
I believe it did.
Okay.
And they built it into the tables, and some people didn't realize that, and they ended up owing a lot of money because they didn't realize it. So that was my understanding.
Yeah. So it potentially is going away from us at the end of this year. Not that anybody's going to go out and get a job between now and the end of the year that didn't have it before, but it's just something to look forward to not getting the benefit in 2011, of course, unless it's extended. Again, energy-efficient appliances. We talked about the energy credit, and people think of windows, and they think of furnaces, and some people think of air conditioner compressors, but it can be for smaller things too, can it?
Insulation, perhaps. Mm-hmm. Even more expensive things like solar paneling. You can get up to almost to a 30% tax credit. If the cost of the solar paneling costs, let's say, $10,000, you're talking about a $3,000 tax credit. Again, with no income limitations, no matter what your income is, you're eligible for this credit. So it's not only just saving on taxes, but hopefully it'll make your home more efficient as far as fuel is concerned, and you'll save money there also. So.
Yeah, I had a client call up, and there's something called geothermal. And to be frank, you know, in the early days, what's geothermal got to do with anybody with a normal home? But geothermal isn't any more exotic than drilling a hole in the ground. I mean, you just don't go out there with a drill bit and do it. But, I mean, you have to go way down and tap the water supply underground that comes up at a constant temperature and then runs through some coils in the home. And I think it can keep the temperature at 55 degrees. So you're not particularly, it'd be nice to cool it in the summer. You're not going to be particularly warm in the winter. But, I mean, this is no cost other than the cost to drill, which isn't inexpensive, but the credit is huge. So for somebody that's going to stay in their home for a very long time, it might not be a bad investment of some dollars. It's not inexpensive, though.
That's correct. It's not a cheap credit.
But when you hear it, geothermal, you just say, oh, that's for somebody else. That's got something to do with oil drilling and the like, but it doesn't. But again, it's for somebody that's going to be in their home for a while to recoup whatever they're going to expend. All right, those are some of the things that probably will go away. We're not sitting here and saying that they are, but it's just saying if they are and you were going to spend the money anyway, do it before the end of the year. And as Ed said, it has to be installed.
By December 31st.
Right. Now we'll switch on over to something tax, but probably got more economics to it. Roth conversions, the good, the not so good, and the potentially ugly. So what's the deal with Roth conversions? We won't talk about how they work. We're going to spend a lot of time on that next week. But you know, summarize it, please, in English so that I can understand it.
Well, let's just review. There are two types of IRAs out there, traditional IRAs, and we have Roth IRAs. Roth IRAs have been around since 1998. There are two ways you can get a Roth IRA. One, contribute to one. Number two is to take a existing traditional IRA and convert it. Convert it means that you're changing the nature of it. With a traditional IRA, you put the money in and at least the earnings grow tax deferred. But when you pull the money out of the traditional IRA, you have to pay tax at least on the earnings. If it was a deductible IRA or the traditional IRA, then you have to pay tax on the contributions when you pull them out. If it's a non-deductible traditional IRA, You already pay tax on the contributions, but you definitely have to pay tax on the earnings that have grown tax deferred. With a Roth IRA, money going in has already been taxed. The earnings that you get within the Roth IRA from year to year are tax free because everything coming out of a Roth IRA is tax free. Everything coming out of the Roth IRA. There are two ways, again, to get the Roth IRA, contribute to one or convert an existing traditional IRA to a Roth IRA. For years ever since they've been around, there have been contributions, there have been limits as far as who can contribute to a Roth IRA. If your income is too high, you're not allowed to contribute to one. Until the year 2010, there were limits on individuals who could convert a traditional IRA to a Roth IRA. But effective January 1st, 2010, anybody, no matter what their income is, no matter what their age is, no matter what their filing status is allowed to convert a traditional IRA to a Roth IRA. Everything came off this year permanently. So anybody who wants to can do it this year. The problem is when you convert a traditional IRA to a Roth IRA, you have to pay tax at least on the earnings. So anything that's accumulated in there, you have to pay tax on when you convert it. So this is the first year everyone's been able to do it. Sounds good on paper, but when people see this, sometimes the tax bill they got to pay, they get very discouraged.
All right, could we take it maybe through three different phases of one's career? The person at the beginning stage of their career, it's probably not going to be an issue with them because they could make the contribution directly to the Roth because their income is lower than what it's going to be mid-career or later on. But if they did have any traditional IRAs, which I doubt, but if they did have any traditional IRAs, more often than not, they probably deducted it. And if they were fortunate and it made money, then 100% of the value of that traditional IRA moved into the Roth would be subject to income tax. So the person might not be too thrilled, but again, if they're at a younger age, you're talking about 30, 35 years, 25 years of tax-free growth, it would well be worth putting money up front. And you wrote an article, who was it for? You write so many articles, but you wrote an article about where's the cash coming from.
It was for the Federal Employees News Digest. I write a column every week for the Federal Employees News Digest called the Informed Investor Column. The article came out a few weeks ago talking about if you're going to convert a traditional IRA to a Roth IRA, you have to be careful that in converting it, any taxes that are due should not come from the IRA itself. You have to find an outside source of income to pay your taxes due on the conversion. So if somebody has some deductible IRAs that they're going to convert, they should have enough liquidity to pay any taxes that are due. That's one possibility in terms of how to do the conversion. There's another way you can do a conversion. And this is what I advise federal employees. If they have some existing traditional deductible IRAs, rather than converting those, they should instead contribute to a non-deductible IRA, pay the tax. They're going to pay the tax on the contributions. By definition, a non-deductible traditional IRA means that the money you're putting into the IRA has already been taxed. And with respect to the traditional deductible IRAs, you'll have to shelter them from tax. And how do you do that? Because the IRS says that you just can't pick and choose the IRAs you want to convert. They're looking at all your IRAs. And you have to take your traditional deductible IRAs and shelter them from tax. And the best way to do that, if you're a federal employee, is to roll them into your TSB account.
They call this the aggregation rules, don't they?
They call them the aggregation rules that many people, unfortunately, are not aware of, and I have an article about that as well.
Good. I call them the aggravation rules, but it basically steps back and says, okay, we don't care whether you have one IRA or 10 IRAs. This is the IRS now talking, and this makes sense, too. And they said included in your universe of IRAs, you've put some in there that you got no tax benefit for, like Ed said, didn't get the tax deduction. And some you may have gotten a tax deduction, but even if you did or didn't, hopefully some of them have grown. So when they look at the sum total of the IRAs, they go, okay, it's equal to X. Now, we as taxpayers have to send the IRS a form each year that a lot of people don't. I think it's a form 8606, and it says, okay, IRS, this is how much I've put into my IRA traditional population where I did not get a tax deduction for.
That's correct. And if you don't send in the form 8606, the IRS says, well, we assume, therefore, that the contributions that you made to your traditional IRA were pre-tax, meaning that your entire IRA is subject to tax when you pull the money out of it.
So make sure that you file one for 2010. But underline this next comment. That doesn't mean you shouldn't have filed them in the past, but at least start off 1 year and do it right. I think in theory you're supposed to file each year that you did invest into a non-deductible traditional IRA.
That's correct, Bob. And the good news about that is if you've done it in the past, if you have contributed to non-deductible traditional IRAs and you did not file the Form 8606 in the years that you did contribute to them, you can go back and download the form from IRS's website. This is Form 8606. Go to IRS's website, irs.gov, www.irs.gov. Download the form, 8606, for the year that you contributed to the non-deductible IRA, no matter what year it has been, and they've been around. Non-deductible traditional IRAs have been around since 1987. That's when the law changed. You just download the form 8606 for the year you contributed to the non-deductible IRA. Report to the IRS on that form what you contributed that year, whether it was $2,000 or $3,000. Send it in, and this way you will establish basis for your IRA that you're not going to be taxed on again when you pull the money out of it. Now, this is all the good news, Bob. Here's the bad news. I understand there's a penalty. And IRS will impose a $50 penalty, I believe.
Per year.
For every year that you miss following that Form 8606. But what I tell employees in class is, well, let's look at the alternative. Suppose you don't contribute. Suppose you do not file the Form 8606. You say, I don't want to pay the $50 penalty. Well, let's suppose back in the year 1994, you contributed the $2,000 to the IRA, to the non-deductible IRA, and you don't file the Form 8606. Well, 30 years later, in the year 2025, you pull that same $2,000 out. You happen to be, let's say, in a 30% tax bracket. You're going to end up paying 30% of $2,000 tax on the money you're pulling out. So 30% of $2,000 is $600. Now, what would you rather pay, $50 now or $600 later? I think $50 is a better deal.
I agree with you. In class, I'm sure you get the same question. How do I know what I put into my IRA? Well, one place to look is your checkbook. If you happen to be at the same investment house, if you will, you could ask them how much you put in. It still doesn't answer the question whether it was deductible or not, so one would have to look at their tax returns, and a lot of people don't keep their tax returns for 23 years, but that would be the only way. And then the bigger question is, well, how much could I have put in each year? Now, next week, we're going to do a show on Roth conversions and voluntary contributions, and one of the pages will have the history of the IRA back to its first year in 74 and how much one could put in, whether they were single, whether they were joint, etc. And you might download that. It's a PDF file that we'll have on there next week. All righty, Ed. Now, let's get so if we're going to do this conversion, we talked about the person at the beginning of a career. Let's take a mid-career person. They may have accumulated some IRAs over the years. They may not. I'm surprised sometimes in class that the younger ones, when they come in, they probably are more impacted by the change in the law in 87, like you say, where they couldn't get a deduction. So people say, if you're not going to give me a deduction, I'm not going to do it. So sometimes these people are actually golden because they have no IRAs. So they don't have any baggage about converting. Of course, they don't have anything to convert would be the negative. But one would have to know what they've done, and generally somebody's going to know if they didn't do it. What they don't know is if they did do it, what was deductible and what was not. But at mid-career, if somebody had been doing it over the years, then we've probably got some growth in there.
Yeah, and again, this is something that needs to consider. Of course, you might have some IRAs that have gone down in value. They would be great candidates to convert, because if you put in, let's say, $2,000 to an IRA years ago, and now it's worth, let's say, $500, you should convert to $500 because you end up paying less tax rather than taking an IRA that you put $2,000 in and now it's grown to $10,000. So you're looking for the IRAs that to convert to the ones that you're going to end up paying less tax.
Right. And you mentioned something. You could strip out the taxable portion of your traditional IRAs and put it into the thrift?
Yes. Since the year 2003, the Thrift Savings Plan allows federal employees to roll over into their thrift accounts any money from a 401k plan. They used to participate in a 401k plan with a previous employer. They have money in a simplified employee pension, a SEP IRA. They have money in a 403b tax sheltered annuity. These are all different types of retirement plans and traditional IRAs with no limit. The only caveat is that any money that you roll into the TSP has to be money that has never been taxed.
And you have to sign an affidavit with the form that that's what you're doing.
That is correct. On its form TSP-60. And I just want to point out that not only can employees do that, but retirees who are younger than 70 and a half are allowed to roll over money into the TSP. In other words, even though they have retired from federal service and they cannot contribute directly to the TSP, they are allowed to roll over money into the TSP from a traditional IRA or from an existing pension plan. As a federal retiree, I'm doing this myself because my company has a pension plan, it's a SEP IRA. We put money in at the end of the year. We've had a good year. And just a few months later, we take the money in that SEP IRA and I roll it back into my TSP account. This is how I keep my TSP account growing. So it can be done after retirement as well.
And you're a CFP.
We keep up with that license too.
All righty. Now let's go to the latter stages of one's career. Now, if we do have IRAs, we've probably had them for a while. And maybe we were of the ilk that in the 70s we could deduct it, and the middle 80s we could deduct it, and then Congress changed their mind, and a number of people said, well, I'll show you, if you won't let me deduct it, I'm not going to put any money into it. So again, we're talking about somebody in the pre-retirement stage of life, and potentially a substantial portion of their traditional IRA world is fully subject to tax. So moving that over to the Roth, you know, may or may not make economic sense, but as you said, where's the money going to come from to pay the tax? It should not come from the money being transferred.
That's correct. Or else you may end up paying, you're going to pay tax on the money you're pulling out of your IRA or your pension plan to pay the taxes. And if you're younger than 59 and a half, there's an additional 10% early withdrawal penalty. So you could end up paying as much as 40 to 50% tax, not to even mention state tax, on the money you're pulling out of your retirement plan or your IRA to pay the taxes that on the amount that you're converting.
Plus, you just messed up the compounding growth issue. You know, I tell people, you're trying to start a fire here. Don't pull the logs out.
Correct. Not good planning.
No. So again, it's we're going to spend a fair amount of time on this next week, because there is actually a substantially updated Form 8606 and available in draft form from the IRS for 2010, which of course that's the year we'll be filing. And they've changed the voluntary contribution form to be able to go directly to a Roth where it wasn't before. So again, we'll hit that and we'll have that in the PDF file. But there's a lot of planning, and I think probably one of the bigger planning pieces is if we are going to move money from a traditional IRA to the TSP, we want to do it by December 31st. So it's just vivid that a January 1st, 2011, the only thing in that IRA is non-taxable money.
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct.
More next week. All righty. Opportunities to consider in reducing 2010 income between now, October 4th and December 31st this year. What can we do?
Federal employees, golden opportunity. Contribute the maximum possible to your thrift savings plan. You're getting an instant tax break by putting the money in. This is deducted from your gross salary, the money you contribute to your TSP. Reduces your gross salary, which in turn makes you less than the amount that you have to pay in taxes, both federal and in most cases state. There are two states that don't follow that. Just so you know, Pennsylvania and New Jersey, I found out, follow that.
Yes, I knew Pennsylvania didn't. I didn't know Jersey. So, Ed, let's say I was asleep at the wheel and I didn't put any money into my thrift for the current year. Could I maybe take all my salary and make it rough to pay the mortgage and food bills. But in theory, I could take all my salary and with the exception of Medicare and Social Security and put it into the thrift.
You have to leave a little room for health insurance premiums.
Perhaps, oh, that,
and,
yeah.
And your contribution to your respective retirement plan, CSRS at first. But other than that, you could take the entire paycheck and put it into the TSP, and you can start this at any time. You can actually, there's no such thing as an open season. Federal employees are allowed to join the TSP at any time and to increase their contributions to the TSP at any time. And since we're talking about that, how much can they put in between now and December 31st?
And how much is that?
Regular contributions, $16,500. And the catch-up contributions, and that's for individuals who are going to be at least age 50 by December 31st, 2010, that's a maximum $5,500 catch-up contribution.
So the sum of those two is pretty big.
It's $22,000.
Yeah, that's a lot of money. So, I mean, if people can do it, they should jump all over it, but that doesn't mean they have to hit $22,000 if it would leave them. Stretch till it hurts, but if you just can't stretch any further, you can put any amount in less than that.
That's correct, and any amount that you put in will definitely save you in federal, in most cases, state income taxes as well.
And if for some reason you're FERS and you haven't done this, run and do it now, because don't they get a match?
FERS employees get a maximum 4% match, not 5%, Bob, because they get automatically 1%, and even if they're not putting any of their own money in, they get a 4% match, but only if they contribute at least 5% of their gross pay. Now, what I point out to FERS employees in class is that 4% maximum match means that the employees have to put in at least 5% of their gross pay each pay date. It's not for the year. If they end up putting in the full $16,500 before their last pay date, they're going to miss out on the 4% matching, because the 4% matching means that you must put in at least 5% of your gross pay each pay date from now to the end of the year.
Okay. So it's a return on their investment before they even invest.
If I tell FERS employees, if you are not putting in at least 5% of your gross pay, then you're leaving 4% of your gross pay on the table. It's free money. And federal employees are so fortunate. Another thing I point out in class is that, you know, if you work in private industry and you have access to a 401k plan, and many companies offer them, so-called highly compensated employees are not allowed to put in as much as lower compensated employees. They have this thing called discrimination testing. If those employees, let's say, who are earning more than $120,000 a year, They could theoretically put in the maximum $16,500 to their retirement plans, but if they end up putting in much more than lower compensated employees, the pension administrator could say, oh no, we have to back out some of your contributions, not allowed. But there is no such discrimination testing when it comes to the TSP. Whether you earn $22,000 a year or whether you earn $250,000 with the federal government, everyone is allowed to contribute the same amount to the TSP.
And the TSP's got a lot of really nice features. That's one that private industry will never have.
It's the envy of private industry.
Yeah.
I can tell you numerous journalists, financial journalists, from Money Magazine, Walter Updegrave, he writes a column, and he says the TSP is the envy of private industry. The man swears by it.
Oh.
And I can tell you about it. I retired from federal service 4 years ago, And I contributed to the TSP on a regular basis. And when I retired, I left my money in the TSP. And here I am, I'm a securities broker. And I could have taken that money and rolled it into an IRA. Didn't want to, because I feel so good about the TSP.
Wow.
So the money's still there.
You retired 4 years ago?
It'll be 5 years in January.
Because, you know, whenever you said retire, I said, how did he retire? He's too young. 4 years ago.
Good planning.
good food, good planning, good wife, good family structure. That's your deal. What else can we do between now and the end of the year?
Well, another thing that we can be doing is taking advantage of our flexible spending accounts, if we have one, and spending them down, because it's going to be a major change in January for people who have flexible spending accounts. Again, just to review, there are two types of flexible spending accounts. One is for health, for healthcare related expenses, and one is for dependent care expense, related expenses. And the maximum you can contribute to each is $5,000. For people who are participating in the dependent care FSAs, it's probably not going to be a problem, end up spending your money, because $5,000 for a dependent care FSA, there are people who have two or three children or more in daycare, end up spending their $5,000 probably by March 1st. But it is the healthcare FSA that some people end up not using their money. And there's a rule with the flexible spending accounts that if you don't use your money, you're going to lose your money. So the deadline for spending your money is actually March 15th. So anybody who has participating in the healthcare or dependent care FSAs has until March for this year has until March 15, 2011 to spend their money. What can it be used on? It could be used to pay for deductibles, co-payments. You can get reimbursed for your mileage to the doctor, to the dentist, to the optometrist. It can be used to pay for glasses, dental care, out-of-pocket dental care, things like dental care, orthodontics. Again, it can be used for many, many things, prescription drugs. And until December 31st, it can be used to pay for over-the-counter medication like cold medicine and aspirin, allergy medicine. But there's going to be a change come January 1st, 2011. As part of the national healthcare reform, you cannot use your FSA to reimburse for over-the-counter medications like cold medicine, allergy medicine, Band-Aids, things like that. It has to be the effective January 1st, 2011, for as far as medication is concerned, it can only be used to pay for the FSA to pay for prescription drugs.
So that would include somebody that had money in from 2010, had not spent it yet. They can't spend it for the same reasons for those first 3 months in the year.
The first two and a half months of the year.
Yeah, two and a half, sorry. Than they did if they had done it before this year.
That's correct.
So that, I mean, that's a huge warning sign.
That's correct. So
Thank you. Be on
guard for that, because the again, the FSAs can be very, very useful, and there's going to be another major change in a couple, in, I think starting in 2013. The healthcare FSA limitations are, as far as maximum you can put into one, will be reduced down to $2,500 from the current $5,000. And OPM announced, I think on Friday, what the health insurance premiums were going to be for 2011 for the federal health insurance plans. On average, they're going up 7.2%. A lot of employees are upset about that. It could have been worse. But that's just the premiums. Now, I just want to point out, you cannot use your healthcare FSA to pay for your premiums that you're paying for your health insurance. I have not looked at the plans yet and what's going to happen, but I have a feeling that in addition to premiums are going up, I think deductibles and co-payments are going to be going up as well for most health insurance plans. So the bottom line is that most employees will be paying more out of pocket for their medical, dental, and vision expenses, and the best way to pay for them is through their health care FSA. So when the open season comes around next month, starting November 8th, through December the 13th, employees should really give some serious consideration to enrolling in the healthcare FSA, and if they're in one, re-enrolling, because they have to re-enroll for 2011, and be prepared to use their FSAs for more expenses than they have been accustomed to, as far as deductibles and co-payments.
Okay, and for those that heard the 7.2% and just shut down after that, it's 7.2% increase, which is high when inflation is close to 1 or 2%. But it's only on their share. It's also on the government's share, but it's the whole 7.2% of the entire premium isn't coming out of their pocket. So what would that be? The government picks up what percentage of the health care premium?
On average, the federal government pays for both employees and retirees 72% of the total cost of the health insurance premiums.
Okay, so just kind of really do it simply. If the health insurance premium was $1,000, don't we wish? But the government would pick up $720,
that's
and the
correct.
Individual would have to pick up $280. So it's 7.2% of the $280, not of the whole $1,000.
That's correct.
That the individual would pay.
That's correct. And this is just the health insurance, Bob, because there is separate dental and vision insurance in which the employees and retirees pay 100% of the premiums. The government does not contribute to those particular plans at all.
Can the flexible spending account pay for long-term care insurance?
No.
Okay.
The flexible spending account cannot pay for any premiums of anything, including long-term care insurance premiums. It can pay for long-term care expenses, but it cannot pay for premiums. Let me just point out, though, that there's another type of spending account for medical purposes. It's called an HSA, a health savings account.
Alphabet soup
that federal employees have access to. They have to enroll in a high deductible health insurance plan to be eligible to contribute to an HSA. And if they have an HSA, they cannot have an FSA. I just want to point out that with a health savings account, unlike a healthcare flexible spending account, you can pull money out of the HSA to pay for long-term care insurance premiums. This is a little bit different.
Okay. We're going to, in an open season, we bring in the insurance companies, and we usually start off the first day by defining the alphabet soup because it's not easy to follow. All righty. What else we got between now and the end of the year?
Well, we were talking earlier about if we have some capital assets that have gone up in value, this might be the year to sell them because of the capital gains tax of 15%. Well, let's go the other way. I'm sure many people have capital assets, stocks, bonds, mutual funds outside of a retirement account that may have gone down in value. And there's very little chance of their coming back in value. Maybe they just are invested in the wrong things. Well, if you sell those capital assets at a loss, you end up getting less for what you paid for them. You can take those capital losses and apply them against any type of capital gains that you may have. And this way you offset your capital gains and you won't pay tax on those gains that are offset by your losses. But what happens if you still have excess losses left over? Well, the law says that you can take up to $3,000 of your capital losses and apply it against other income, such as salary income, interest income, rental income, and you'll save on taxes right there. So there is a nice little opportunity there to save on taxes by getting rid of things that you know are not going to ever come back in value.
And the words spoken by the author of The Wise Investor and The Wise Tax Planner.
Well, I was going to show my age here, Bob. How long has the $3,000 limit been around?
As long as I've been doing tax returns, which is 42 years.
I think it was passed in 1978, which is about 32 years ago.
Okay.
It hasn't changed.
Whatever. All righty. We're coming. We just have a few more minutes, and I did want to say something about proposed 2011 tax rates. Nobody should mishear that comment. These are not proposed by any legislation whatsoever because there hasn't been any. But I was frustrated by somebody had to have used a tax rate schedule in order to do the budget. So I Googled one day 2011 tax rates used in budget. Bam, out pops this table. And it's going to be in our PDF file next week. And interestingly enough, for most folks, unless their taxable income is extremely high, these tax rates that were used in the budget would only affect those with huge taxable incomes. And for most people, it wouldn't affect them at all. And oddly enough, for some that might have what was considered to be high income in the federal sector, they might go down a little bit. So I don't know that these will wind up being legislated in, but at least it's some indication the way somebody was thinking. And now you read about the compromise between the Republicans and the Democrats, and I am not a political beast. I always stay right in the center. I don't know what that's going to be, but I do know what this says, and it seems to me if that was the thinking, maybe there's more to it than that. But it's anybody's guess what 2011 rates are going to be, but at least that I could look at and say, but look what they did. recharacterization of a Roth IRA. I know that you've written on that, and I know before we started the show, you said, gee, you know, I'd like to spend some time on that.
Well, recharacterization is sort of undoing your Roth IRA conversion. Let's suppose back in the year 2009, you took a traditional IRA, and you decided, I'd like to convert that to a Roth IRA. And let's assume, for sake of argument, that you were eligible to do it. There wasn't, you know, you're below the income limits because, as I mentioned a few moments ago, that before 2010, there were some limitations regarding who could take a traditional IRA and convert it to a Roth IRA. Effective January 1st, 2010, those limits came off. No matter what your income is, you can convert it. But back in 2009, you were eligible to convert a traditional IRA to Roth IRA, and you did it. And now, it's a year later, you decided that was not a good idea for whatever reason. One example was that let's say you had a $40,000 IRA, all of which, when you converted it, you had to pay tax on. Now, let's say you were in a 25% tax bracket. So 25% of $40,000, you owe the government $10,000. But here's a year later, your IRA has gone down in value from $40,000 down to $10,000. You've lost $30,000. And you said, gee, I have to pay tax on something that's gone down in value? Well, the government has come to your rescue because you have an opportunity to undo the conversion. And if you make that decision to undo the conversion, but no later than October 15, 2010, everything will be forgiven. You will owe the government nothing in tax, and you'll get your traditional IRA back that you converted. Of course, it's only going to be worth $10,000, but you will owe the government no tax. Now, again, the deadline is pretty strict, October 15th.
Great.
And better, if you have converted it and you've paid tax, and you did convert it and pay tax, you amend your taxes and you can get your money back.
Wow.
In taxes.
All righty. And the last comment we had is alternative minimum tax. We're going to try to do this in a minute and 10 seconds. Long story short, everyone, I think, knows how they file a tax return. Income minus deductions, and then you figure your tax. Alternative minimum tax takes that same calculation and just puts it over in another column and says, well, you know, alternatively, we're not going to allow you to deduct certain things. And then they deny the deduction using the same numbers, but they recalculate the tax on, it's effectively a flat tax, but at a higher rate. And so the alternative minimum tax on one's form appears to be a penalty. But really what it is, it's the difference between the total tax under the alternative way and under the regular way. And you just pay the higher of the two numbers, but it really grates people. And I say, gee, if they raise tax rates, I don't know that your tax return is going to change any if in the alt-min tax, because the alt-min goes down, the regular one goes up. Anyway, that's a very fast explanation of the alt-min tax. I'm sure we'll spend some more time on it at another time, but really key in on the word alternative minimum tax, and it was designed to tax people at a minimum rate that were using abusive tax shelters.
I advise clients that they should always, always consider the AMT, because more and more of us are paying it, and if you do your own taxes, make sure if you use something like TurboTax that you run IRS Form 6251, because you may not be aware of it, but you are subject to the AMT.
IRS Form what is it?
6251. IRS Form 6251.
Well, you know that stuff, huh? Yeah, I remember doing taxes many years ago. I'm in a geese here, and people made just big money and didn't pay tax because of super duper deductions. And that's really was the genesis of this. Anyway, Ed, we have very few seconds left here. Final comments?
Final comments. To save on taxes this year, TSP contributions are number one. As far as the Roth is concerned, if you're not eligible to contribute to one, you don't want to pay the tax on converting one. Federal employees have a golden opportunity starting in a couple years. The TSP will offer the Roth TSP. That'll start in 2012.
Okay. Great, Ed. Sorry. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week to talk about TSP conversions and Roth conversions and the like. Thank you for listening.
You've been listening to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP. Please tune in next Monday at 10 a.m. for a topic solely